Well, how to better equip teachers, parents and learners in today's fast-changing world? Is the way we learn to learn changing? Or are the basics more important than ever? Barbara Oakley is Distinguished Professor of Engineering at Oakland University in California. Her popular online course, Learning How to Learn, has reached over 4 million people globally. She's in New Zealand speaking to educators about neuroscience, psychology, artificial intelligence, neurodiversity and creativity, and to provide practical tools for people who struggle with traditional approaches to learning. Barbara Oakley is also working on a study into declining IQ scores in developed countries, linked to changing educational practices and the rise of cognitive offloading via AI and digital tools. She's with me in the Wellington studio. Great to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, Catherine.
That's great. What are some of the main issues educators and parents have been raising with you in New Zealand?
I think the biggest issue is how much do we allow students to use generative AI like ChatGPT, and how much do we make them learn and keep within their own memory? And the real challenge is that teachers have often been taught you can just tell students to look it up because, you know, they can always just get it online. But that carries a lot of danger. It turns out that in Finland, for example, there are problems with nursing students because what nursing students will do is if you said to them, for example, 12 times 12 is 129, they would say, sounds good to me, because they have not internalized the multiplication tables. And what this means is if they accidentally punch a wrong button on a calculator, 10 times 10 equals 1,000, they think, that sounds good to me, and they prescribe something that could potentially be lethal.
So the ability to estimate, to know whether an answer is in the ballpark, comes from having learned to do these calculations in the first place, even if you later outsource it to a calculator.
It comes from your own internal knowledge. In fact, critical thinking about anything we get from ChatGPT or anything else comes fundamentally from our own internal knowledge. I have a friend who wrote a book, and he sent it to me. He was so overjoyed. This was just a wonderful book. It was the worst book you ever read. It was boring, tangential, terrible writing, horrible plotting. But he did not have the internal knowledge from having widely read a lot of different novels to even know how terrible it was. Having internal knowledge is all the more important in this day and age where we think we can outsource everything.
Because you can discern.
You can't discern. You will just accept unless you have internal knowledge that says, whoop, wait, no, that's not right. It doesn't follow. You have to have something inside you. But the problem is that teachers who are really magnificent here in New Zealand, I've met so many, have long been taught that memorization is really bad, that comprehension is really the golden key. But I had a student come up to me once. He'd flunked one of my statistics tests, and he said, how could I flunk this test? I understood it when you said it in class. And we've gotten so overboard that, you know, understanding is far more important than knowing that we fall into these traps.
Can we talk about some of the biology of the brain as well at this point? Let's just digress for a moment, because that ability to learn we might call exercising a muscle. And there's a thing called working memory that you will need no matter how many appliances you've got. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to hold a certain amount of detail in your mind for a period of time in order to do a useful task. Can we talk about some of what is happening in the brain when we are doing that, when we are learning, when we are memorizing? We can outsource anything to computers, but that process in our own brain involves what?
So that process involves two different forms of memory. Working memory, which is what we're holding temporarily in mind, and which we can't improve pretty much it, what we have is what we've got. And then long-term memory, what we store. And we can increase our store of what we've got in long-term memory. A great way to do this is, for example, with learning a new language. You practice storing things in long-term memory. Unfortunately, in New Zealand, language learning has been de-emphasized. So next week, for example, I'll be talking to the Language Forum. They have a free conference on the 17th about the importance of language learning. And I think what's so important about it is that it helps you revitalize that skill of storing information in long-term memory, which is what is so very important and what is being lost in current education.
Explain
approaches.
Why it's important. I've got some suggestions, but you go. Why is it important to be able to carry memories and access memories and also organize them into filing cabinets? Why does that matter when we've got all this stuff today?
So poets will sometimes say, memorize the poem and you will understand it more deeply. As an engineering professor, I say, why should we let the poets have more, all the fun? In fact, by remembering and thinking about things, retrieving information, you begin to understand it more deeply. Michael Nielsen, the physicist, for example, would try to remember this key theorem he was working on. And by simply remembering, pulling to mind over many days, he was able to come up with a new way of proving this theorem.
Does this matter to creativity? You mentioned the poets, but whatever form of creativity, is your having experienced others and learned it and then recalling it also feeding your own?
If, let's say that I went to ChatGPT and I came up, or it gave me a fantastic new theory of physics. Well, if I'm trained as an artist, I'd look at it and go, so what? I have no knowledge within my head to even begin to understand what that theory is or why it could be important. You have to have underlying knowledge within you to be able to appreciate and use the insights that ChatGPT is giving.
Memory is also important to imagining, and I know that this is important to mental health. I know research being done by New Zealand researchers that shows a correlation between someone in a very deep state of depression and activity in the part of their brain that deals with memory and imagining. So it is actually, it is fulfilling all sorts of roles to have that capacity. Can we talk about working memory again? And this again is the point. Why do I need to remember, I'm doing long division, and why do I need to remember that I've carried the this and done the that and now I'm going into that, when I've got a calculator that can do it? Why do I need to be able to recall some kind of mathematical equation and hold it for a period of time in order to complete a task? Why will this always be important?
Because, for example, what is hard for people to understand is there's two major learning systems in the brain. There's one that's declarative through the hippocampus, and that is how we get a language explained to us as an adult. But that other system is the system of patterns. That's the basal ganglia system. That's how we learn our native language. And we need, if we want to understand the patterns of mathematics, we need to have an understanding of these basic processes. For example, my younger daughter, she thought she was an artist, you know, and she's a really good artist. But she just didn't want to learn math because she was very creative. And so I insisted that for 10 years she would do an extra 20 minutes of a day of math practice through that program called Kumon Mathematics. Well, she went out in the working world, became an artist, and suddenly realized it's really tough. And besides that, there's wonderful patterns out there. So she went back and got her master's degree in statistics. I met the son of her graduate advisor who she wrote papers with, and he said, you know, I just don't get it. My father never takes students who go through the American educational system because they simply don't have a feel for the numbers. What's different about your daughter? And I was like, 10 years of an extra 20 minutes a day of practice so that she could get a feel for those numbers.
We need concepts for things. We don't need to know the answer to every equation, but we need to understand the concept of what that equation is doing or representing.
That can fool you because, again, that could be like that engineering student who came up to me and said, you know, I understood the concept.
Yeah, yeah.
But he got everything all wrong because he didn't remember. He hadn't right. deeply internalized those concepts.
Right. Come back to what's happening with the arrival now. Digital tools, the large language learning models in particular, ChatGPT, Microsoft Copilot, Google's Gemini, which is going to quite young children now. How is all this affecting educators and learners in 2025? What are they telling you? The changes that are happening for better or for worse, what do they want to know about using these tools as that? Tools and not replacements.
So the important thing that I notice, there's a small minority of teachers and psychologists who will say, well, just don't. What you want to do is have your students be able to do things that ChatGPT can't do. I'm like, good luck with that, you know. But most are very nervous, but they don't know how to grapple with this new revolution. And what I help provide is an insight that supports their own underlying intuition that students need to know things. They need to have information within their own brains. In fact, what I believe would be very important and beneficial is for teachers to make a list of what their students should know by heart in any given class. They should be able to walk out and say certain things, know certain things, and be able to do certain things by heart without, you know, an open book test or looking on ChatGPT.
Are we at the point where some children can't actually memorize and hold in their memory something like a short poem or some mathematical equation or some kind of historical knowledge?
Here's what happens if we don't hold them to those standards. In the U.S., they stopped teaching about dates in history because that's trivial facts that you can just look up. Well, then what they found was that students thought that, well, the Civil War, which was in the 1800s, and
was
civil rights
this.
Was
yeah.
in the 1900s. Oh, and so Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King must have been friends. And so those simple dates, they looked deceptively easy to throw out, but they're actually, they provide a very good structure.
I mean, you and I are both doing the same thing. I'm doing a physical timeline as you're speaking to me and putting these things on a timeline.
Yeah.
But if you just go to this and then go to that, is that sense of time, is that sense of chronology even able to be developed in someone if they just hit this for this question and this for that question?
Trust me, in China, for example, people don't go around saying, you can always just look it up. It's not important to remember. I mean, you've got 6,000 characters to look up. And so as a consequence, you do not see, as it seems, that decline in IQ scores or cognitive ability that you see in Western countries.
Let's come to that. I want to come back to the advice you give, because these tools aren't going away. They're going to be obligatory in people's work lives, in many instances they are already. So I want to come back to how to get ahead of a problem and work out what the human brain should be doing and how the tool should be used. But you've just gone to this issue called the memory paradox and your hypothesis for low IQ scores. Before that, the Flynn effect. Explain what that was and why it is now apparently being reversed, please.
So Flynn effect. So James Flynn was an American who came and lived here for many years, and he found that IQ scores have apparently gone upwards from the 1930s to the 1970s. But subsequent researchers have found that after the 70s, there started to become a decline. And of course, when it was going up, educators all took credit for it. But now that it's declining, everybody's kind of like, whoop, it's not me. But the reality is, what happened in the 70s? That's when calculators came out. And it wasn't the calculators that were the problem. It was people, you know, psychologists and teachers, well-meaning though they were, saying, you don't need to remember these things. You can always just look them up. And even within families, you can see a difference in IQ scores between the younger and the older students who have gotten different education. There was a major educational research project that was the biggest one ever in history. And what they found, it was a $100 million 10-year study, was that some ways of teaching actually cause students to regress. So let's look. Part of my own research involves pathologies of altruism. I published in the National Academy of Sciences proceedings, in Oxford University Press. And when something sounds good, people can all pile on board with it. And one thing that has sounded really good is student-centered learning, child-centered learning, that the child knows and integrates the knowledge themselves. Well, you know, I'd say put a child in a room and ask them to come up with French. You know, you just can't do it. That's why language teachers are so important and why learning a language can be so valuable. But it's the same with math. It took us thousands of years to even come up with the idea of the zero. And it took these thousands of years because we have 100 trillion synapses in our brain. It's such high dimensionality. There are so many ways to think wrongly about some concept, very few about how to think correctly. So when you put students, it's amazing. In California, there are some classrooms where teachers walk around with their hands behind their backs and they're not allowed to say a word in math class. Can you believe that? And then they can't understand why their test scores are declining.
Barbara Oakley is our guest, Distinguished Professor of Engineering at Oakland University, California, and of course also renowned as a speaker and writer on neuroscience, psychology, artificial intelligence, neurodiversity and creativity, the subjects that she's talking about while she's in New Zealand. Come back then to this issue of the lowering of IQ scores and what is happening not only with teaching methods but now the adoption of these tools. What just expand a little bit more on your hypothesis and I guess what you also see therefore as some of the solutions to this. What's actually happening?
So first, one must look at what New Zealand scores have done, for example, on the PISA test, an international test of how you stand, for example, in mathematics ability with children. New Zealand over the past 30 years has gone from the top of the industrialized world to the bottom. And, you know, part and parcel of that has been New Zealand's active embrace of student-centered constructivist approaches to teaching. Well-meaning. It sounds so good, but if you know anything about how the brain actually learns, you understand that, yes, students do create their own knowledge, but there's so many ways to go wrong that you need that guided Socratic questioning to help you get close enough to make that little final intuitive leap. So with ChatGPT and so forth being available, it's so important that we begin to understand that we've got to have students have that knowledge within them. And the sad part is that schools of pedagogy have wonderful professors throughout them, but they have been schooled in old doctrines from 20, 30, 50, you know, they'll be praising people who are 100 years in the past. And we need new pedagogy experts who know about AI, who know about neuroscience, and who are really practically experienced in the classroom.
What are your takeaways at this stage, your conclusion at this stage about how to use these tools specifically the large language models which are prevalent now, but more to come, how to use these tools without hampering the development of these critical cognitive and reasoning skills. Where are you at right now as practical advice to teachers and to parents?
Step back into traditional approaches to teaching that ensure that students have that knowledge within their own brain. Don't be afraid to have simple tests that see whether facts are in the brain. And don't be afraid to test in an environment where students cannot access generative AI. I go to India, for example, and I find banks of assessment rooms where students cannot get onto the internet, and they are really ensuring that their students actually learn the material themselves. And an important point here is my colleagues in the United States who are in schools of engineering, schools of mathematics, sciences, they're by and large from countries that still respect the value of at least a modicum of some rote learning.
There's also a study, I think, in Ghana that shows that the use of an AI-powered math tutor in this instance did assist math scores. This is not an either-or. It's learning what the right balance is and when. What did that show, that study?
So what that study showed was, in essence, if you give enough guidance to get close enough for the student so that they can make that final leap themselves, which is what a good face-to-face teacher does, then students can learn really well.
So the app didn't give the answer. It right. got you so far, and then you had to finish.
Right. But it got you closer and closer as you needed to be.
Excellent. Sounds like a tool we've been discussing that's actually a New Zealand-developed tool. So it is supporting you in the way a skilled teacher would support you to work through the process, get through the process, correct you or help you when you've gone astray, mm-hmm. but get to the outcome. And that particular tool showed substantial improvement in math scores in that cohort.
Yes. And I think, you know, it really tells physical living teachers you want to be upping your game as well, because students will benefit from real human teachers, and you want to make sure that you're still in the game. As they say sometimes, AI is not going to replace you, but people who know how to use AI will replace you.
So is the education system in any country you're familiar with really grappling with that? Not just plonking devices in classrooms, but working on the pedagogy that should accompany it, the learning and teaching protocols that should accompany it?
I have to point a finger to Taiwan. Taiwan experimented with a constructivist student-centered approach for 6 years in the 1990s, and they realized what havoc that was wreaking on their students, threw it out, went back to traditional approaches, and of course now the country is exploding with wonderful innovations in the world of AI because they have a highly educated, very technically competent set of students, cadre of population to work with.
Neurodiversity is another area of research. It's an area that so much more attention finally has been paid to, including increasingly in the education system itself, although that system is not delivering for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. What are some of the points you're making while you're here about a system that does deliver?
So one thing to be aware of is part of the challenge, I think, in schools of pedagogy today is they don't teach, you know, according to what we know from brain science about how the brain actually learns. There's those two different pathways by which we can get information into a long-term memory. And one of them is for habitual things like, you know, like learning a language. But the thing is, when you don't have these this kind of knowledge, it's really hard when it comes to neurodiverse students, what can happen is, for example, a student who has dyslexia can have challenges with that automatic learning system. And what this means is it's kind of like the famous kickboxer Bill Wallace. He had a damaged left knee or right knee. And so he learned to use that left leg really well. and he became a world champion. In a similar way, so if one system's damaged, the other one overcompensates. That happens in the brain as well. So in a person with dyslexia, they can overcompensate with that hippocampal system, and they can do visualization that we simply can't do. Whereas on the other hand, a person who might be on this autistic spectrum, they can have incredibly powerful automatic systems. This automatic system means that you can see the patterns, but you can't explain it. So then when a teacher says, well, if you can't explain it, you don't know it. That's not true. You like if I said, I go to the store yesterday, you know it's wrong. But if I asked you why, you wouldn't know that, well, maybe you would, the etymology of the word that explains, you just know it's wrong. So in a similar way, one who is a student who's on that autistic spectrum, they can know mathematics at a very deep level, see these patterns intuitively and quickly. And then when we say, oh, well, you have to explain it, that's that other system that's not very good. And we can turn them off of school.
That's our problem, isn't it? It's the system's problem. And is it getting any better at making it possible for that knowledge to be, and this is what we do, to be measured or to be recognized or to be enabled?
All we have to do is look towards Taiwan. There are no perfect systems, but they are really teaching in a very solid, good way. They've got great, innovative tools to give to teachers, instructional guides, and follow along with some of these kinds of ideas.
Last thing I want to bring up with you, because I love this bit, when you're trying to encourage your student, or yourself actually, because we're all getting lazy when it comes to, you know, the amount of digital stimulus in our lives. When you're trying to teach yourself to really learn and memorize information again, I love your advice. What do you do when you're stuck? What do you do when you're putting yourself through this hard process and you're stuck?
I asked ChatGPT for motivational ideas. It works great. And I ask it also, how can I be more curious about what I'm learning? Because curiosity, once you get that little curious hook in you, once that hook is satisfied, you actually learn the material better. And overall, one thing, we used to think you were born with all the neurons you'd ever have, but then they die and, you know, you get dumber. And,
we cast them off, I think, when we're very young. We're shedding them. That's why babies are so kind of manic. They've got far too much going on in there.
We're pruning away.
Pruning, exactly.
But the thing is, new neurons are born every day, yes, especially in the hippocampus. And those new neurons will survive, thrive, and grow if you are learning new things. And the great thing is they make you feel better. So if you learn new things, you will not only learn them, but you will also feel better.
Little dopamine hits are there. I thought you were going to tell me to sleep, because that was always my trick when I was studying, when I just got absolutely hit the wall. Because that memory you were talking about, sometimes you could almost see it. Just even a nap, you could almost see the drawers being opened and things being put into them.
We often think we only learn when we're focusing, but taking that break, and especially when we're sleeping, that's when all these little connections are actually kind of sealing into place.
It's actually an exciting time in your field, isn't it? Because the tech is here and it's staying.
Yeah.
And the real contribution now will be learning how to make the order right, you know, the human learning and then using the tool.
Exactly.
Before the tools take over us, which is possible too, Barbara, down the track.
We won't go there.
Thank you very much, Barbara Oakley. She's in New Zealand presently, Distinguished Professor of Engineering at Auckland University. And her MOOC on how to learn, it's probably more than 4 million now. What are you up to now?
Oh, it's, well, if you count all the different languages, around 6 million and different platforms. So it just keeps growing.
Thank you for coming in.